Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week include Jonathan O'Dell, whose wonderful novel, new in paperback, is The Healing, Larissa LeClaire, founder of the Indie Photo Book Library, who's coming to town for Photo NOLA, the celebration of photography in New Orleans, and we'll talk with Jordan Soika, who, as his alter ego Francis Shadfly, is the maitre d' of the New Orleans poetry brothel. Jonathan O'Dell may live in Minnesota, but his is a strong and true Southern voice. In his first novel, The View from Delphi, he created an unforgettable cast of African-American maids and a white ally at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. And in his most recent book, The Healing, just out in paperback, he gives us an inspiring look into the world of African-American midwives in 1860s Mississippi. Jonathan, welcome to The Reading Life.
Susan, it's great to be here.
Now, you've taken a bit of a winding road to fiction. You grew up in Mississippi. Your father was the president of Sanderson Farms.
Yeah.
You sold books door to door.
Right.
You moved on to great success in corporate America. And here you are, reconnecting with your own past in fiction.
It's wonderful coming home again.
Mm-hmm.
Fiction is the thing that did bring me home again.
And how was that?
I grew up in Mississippi as a kind of a closeted gay man, and I made it until I was 29 years old and then just had to escape. I had to create a new life, and I told myself that I would take the job that took me the furthest away, and that was happened to be in Minnesota. And I went into business. I was a businessman and formed my own company and was successful, but I think it was Tom Wolfe who said you can never go home again. He was only half right, because you could never quite leave either. Parts of our unfinished stories, I believe, especially those that we had to cut off early, like I did with mine in Mississippi, keep calling to us to finish those stories, to resolve them. And that's why I wrote the first book, The View from Delphi. I went back to Mississippi and interviewed all the people that I could find that grew up around my parents' age and my age, and tried to piece together the stories of those things that were happening around me while I was too self-absorbed on surviving to notice. So Delphi brought me back home to Mississippi to find those stories, my parents' stories, my father's stories, my ancestors, and also the stories of African Americans who I grew up not seeing. They were more or less the background of my life, but played a critical part in shaping who I am.
So how did the writing part of your journey begin for you? Because you had written other works. You've written other things in your work as a corporate consultant. I mean, that book, Courageous Conversations, is certainly well known. But fiction is a different animal.
Yeah, I tried to write the first book about Mississippi as nonfiction, and it started to become a memoir. But when I write in my own voice, I sound kind of preachy and over-sentimental, and all the focus is on me. And I had a writing teacher says, you're a beautiful writer. Why don't you try writing something about something besides yourself? It's like you're a bottomless hole when you write. So I had written a little bit about my mother and a little bit about a maid that I had when I was 5 years old in the house. And unlike the other books about Southerners who write about their maids, I didn't love mine. I hated mine, and she hated me.
Whoa.
But when I was five, we had this battle. I was trying to get her out of the house. I was trying to get her fired so my mother could quit work and come home. And so I wrote that little piece, and my writing teacher said, now, these two women are fascinating characters. Why don't you make up a childhood for each of those? And when I did that, then the voices took over. To write anything, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, you have to hear, you have to hear a voice in your head. And when these women started talking, it brought back all the women of my life, back on my grandparents' farm, my aunts and my great-aunts and my grandmother, those strong, strong women. Those voices gave me stories. And what was interesting is, I've heard other novelists say this, is they can better approach the truth by writing fiction than nonfiction. So when I finished Delphi and also The Healing, I found out that my characters were telling the truths, the that I really originally wanted to start anyway.
Well, you certainly used the truth of being that young boy who wanted the maid out of the house in Delphi. I mean, whoa, he was really inventive.
You know, I looked her up on a trip to Mississippi. I talked to my dad, and he said, you know, this maid's still living. I hadn't seen her since I was 5. And I wondered, oh, my gosh, should I take a book out to her? And I called her up, and I said, you don't remember me. Her name was Alma. And probably, but you used to babysit for my father and I had two brothers. She says, are you Johnny? You were the worst little boy I've ever seen. So we didn't have a tearful reunion.
Oh, no neat forgiveness on both sides or anything.
I know.
Oh, you write so much about women. And right. Polly Shine, the character who's at the heart of the healing, is such a marvelous creation.
Thank you.
How did she come to you?
Yeah, I wish I could take credit for her. All the other characters I picked up from history books, especially around Mississippi history. I just love to read Mississippi history, so Silas came from the Montgomerys who formed Mound Bayou and et cetera. And the Satterfields were kins of the Percys in my mind from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
But Polly just came full bore. It was after reading pages and pages and pages of WPA slave narratives, narratives that were interviews that were done with ex-slaves in the 1930s and 40s in Mississippi. And those voices, her voice just came on strong. And then I got a chance to meet a 92-year-old midwife in Midnight, Mississippi. Her name is Ms. Willie Turner, and I have the interview on my website if you'd like to listen. But she became Polly Shine, and she just started talking about birthing babies and catching babies. And she had this spiritual strength and this communal strength that was overwhelming. She's one of those rare people who you meet in your life when you shake their hands. It feels like you've just been blessed.
Yeah.
She had that kind of power. I could just understand why women would just turn themselves over to her to be healed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who I wanted to create, because I think that history got lost about how strong and improvisational and creative that these women were, even on slave plantations all the way up through Jim Crow, these women who were center of these communities because they understood the power of healing, to heal the spirit, not only the body.
Well, just that whole notion of the plantation hospital for the slaves and Polly's incredible influence because of that, and that whole atmosphere and apprenticeship and everything that went on there. It's obvious you did lots of research about this.
Yet, luckily, there are a lot of feminist scholars now who are looking back into our assumptions that we made about slave plantations,
mm-hmm.
and even Jim Crow and the Civil Rights Movement. And now they're finding it wasn't the black men necessarily who carried the load. It was the black women working in the shadows and more subversively, because healing is a very subversive thing. It's a thing that you can do silently. It's a gift of love. But once you've been healed by somebody who is like you, that empowers you.
Right.
Takes the power away from the master race, as the whites were considered. So even though she was healing and saving the slaves or the slave stock, she was also imbuing them with a sense of power. She was identifying them as creatures who had souls.
And was very subversive in
very
that way,
subversive.
Too.
The master didn't know what he hit him. I think that's a lot that the Civil Rights Movement, when Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy and et cetera, we see those men as the ones who are leading it. But what we're just now learning is that those men stood on the shoulders of women, who subversive, the mothers and the field workers like Fannie Lou Hamer, those people who took all the risks to create communities in which King could come and then play the starring role.
Right.
The women's work that I found, even in my own family, it was never up front, but it was extremely powerful and extremely subversive, because it wasn't okay for women to step out front, that they would get pushed back. But they could work behind the scenes in very powerful ways.
Now, in addition to the idea of healing, the themes of story and community resonate throughout your work, through both books. And you have some very complex and lovely ideas about story, and that's been at the heart of your work for a long time, hasn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm. It has been. It's started with my own therapy when I moved to Minnesota, and I got into treatment because I drank my way through safety in Mississippi. That's the only way I could survive and be gay in Mississippi was to medicate myself. And in fact, I highly recommend it. If you have to grow up gay in Mississippi, I recommend drinking. And when I got to Minnesota, I realized that I didn't have to do that anymore But quitting an addiction is the easy part, is healing the brokenness that underlies the addiction, the reasons why you drink. And I discovered that my own personal story was broken. I had been fed a lie about being a white man. My entire history was built on secrets, my family history, as well as the history of who I was as a Mississippian. And as a gay man, I'd been told totally lies about what gay people were. And, of course, I grew up fundamentalist, so immediately I had a lot of shame and guilt about who I was. Mm-hmm. So I realized to heal myself, I had to go back and take care of my own stories. I had to mend my own stories. And when I started following that theme about healing stories, that's when I understood the power that whites had over blacks, or any oppressing society has over the people they oppress. The first thing they do, they attack the people's story. They try to rename things in the people's lives. They try to degrade them. They take away their heroes. They take credit for all their strength. I heard a quote, so somebody said, the problem with identity theft is that when you get your identity stolen, they only take the good parts. And I think that's what the master race does to those people that they subjugate. They take all the good parts of their story and just leave them shambles.
And the other great thing about this is the exchange of stories in the healing. It's that getting stories out of people in addition to telling your own.
I think there's a powerful thing. I think we see this all through literature in the Bible, is that for a story to be effective, there's got to be a witness as well. And when I tell you my story, Susan, my story will evoke your own story. That's one of the wonderful things about story, is one story evokes another story in another person. So as we sit there storytelling and listening, we're knitting up our own relationship together.
Mm-hmm. You've also written in a marvelous essay called Coming Home, I read that in the Utney Reader, about your life as a gay Christian.
Right.
And isn't that the subject of your next book?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm taking this theme that we're talking about now, about being a person who with broken stories. And I've just noticed that when I talk about this, more and more people are telling me they feel the same way about their own story. They're not clear about their family story, or they're trying to retell the story of who they are. A lot of people leave the corporate world, and all of a sudden, that story of being a corporate man or a woman is no longer theirs. They have to ask, well, who am I now? And there are a lot of people asking, who am I now? So I'm writing a book based on my own stories. I had three stories that I was given to survive the South. One was how to be a man, one was how to be white, and the other was how to be Christian. And each of those stories, we're born into a universe already filled with stories. So when we're young, we look for the stories to fit on us like suits so that we don't stand out. Eventually, if we're healthy, we outwear those stories that our parents and our community gives us, and we start to weave our own stories. What I found is the things that I hated about myself the most, the things about like I was sensitive or like I was artistic or that I had a great sense of humor, or I could be silly. Those things didn't fit into my narrative of how to be a man. I had to forget those and bury those and put those aside. But I think every time we leave an important piece of ourselves behind, just so we can fit in, we also leave a promissory note saying, one day I'll come back and I'll recover you. And I think that's what that means being an adult, is to go back and recover those things that we had to put aside. And we often find those are the treasures.
Well, you certainly recovered some amazing things in these novels, and I can't wait for the next book.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I appreciate that.
Well, come on out and meet Jonathan Odell at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center Thursday, November 29th at 6:30 p.m. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it, Susan.
Me too. Jordan Zoika is a poet who received his MFA from Louisiana State University and now teaches at Southern University of New Orleans. He's here today to talk about the New Orleans Poetry Brothel. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Susan.
The Poetry Brothel was originally founded in New York City. So how did you find out about it, and what started you on the path to bring it to New Orleans?
Well, I had heard they were having an inaugural event here in New Orleans that I had to miss, unfortunately. But I got to meet Stephanie Berger, who started the New York Brothel at Mimi's Bar, and got to read her some poems in a corner real quick before I had to jet out. And apparently they made an impression. So about 6 months later, the people who were originally going to run it here had to leave the state, and she contacted me and asked me to take the reins.
I love that. That sounds like the archetypal yeah. New Orleans literary experience. I had to read her some poems in a bar. You know? So how did you set about starting up here?
Well, I started off with just contacting the poets that I knew. I knew a lot of people from LSU. I'd met some people in New Orleans, and I just started putting out flyers all over the different cafes and bars and praying that people would contact me.
And it sounds like they did.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Now, there's something very special about this kind of reading mm-hmm. and this kind of themed atmosphere.
Yes.
So how do you set it up?
Well, we're having our first event in the Always Lounge just because it has that kind of Victorian feel already. But a lot of it really depends on the poets themselves. You know, having that kind of one-on-one reading, it's really on them to create this kind of personal, intimate atmosphere when they're with, you know, whoever is purchasing a private reading from them.
But poets aren't the only ones who are part of the Poetry Brothel.
No, we have buskers who are going to be performing. We have burlesque dancers, a live band. There are acrobats. There'll be a guy on stilts. And the same guy is also going to be doing cyanotype printing during the show. We try to make it almost like an interactive gallery. So there's the music going on. There are the tarot card readings and everything. And throughout all of this, we encourage patrons to come and buy private readings from our poetry whores. So as the maitre d', I'm selling tokens for individual readings. And people can go whenever they want. We just try to create an environment where people aren't just staring at the stage waiting for the next thing to happen. There's always something going on in some corner of the room in some way that they can be involved and be seen or partaking in something.
So does the maitre d' and does the madam facilitate introductions as well?
Yes. So at the beginning of the evening, we'll be introducing everyone, giving them a little sample of what the poets are like. And I'll be doing the same throughout the night, helping people pick, are you looking for a love poem? Are you looking for a serious poem? Are you looking for a funny poem? Well, this is who you would want to, mm-hmm. to buy a reading from then.
So like another sort of brothel, there's a communal experience, and
exactly.
then there's an intimate one-on-one experience.
Yes,
is
exactly.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
So who will the poets be at this reading?
Well, I'll be there as the maitre d', Frances Shadfly. Kim Vodica is going to be our madam, Scarlett O'Harrissey. And then the other poets are going to be Adam Atkinson, Aimé Saint-Savant, Anne DeLott, Charles Garrett, Chris Shipman, Izzy Onrick, Jen Nunes, and Katie Booms.
So do you read all their work ahead of time? Do you choose them, or can anyone take part in this?
Yeah, they all applied. They sent me, some of the people I already knew, mm-hmm. but everyone sent me a small portfolio, and they created a character with a fake bio for that character, and I chose them, based on how good they are at performing, how good their poetry is.
Is there anything else even like this that you can think of?
It is very unique in New Orleans. Yeah, mm-hmm. It breaks down that kind of passive dynamic that you often have in literary readings where you have, you're just listening to someone read somewhere up on a stage or behind a lectern. And that kind of reading is valuable. I love going to reading, regular poetry readings too. But yeah, I feel like this is kind of unique in New Orleans anyway.
That sense of an overall experience and a surround.
Yes.
I think that will make it very special. So how can people join in or take part in this?
Well, the event will be November 29th. The Always Lounge starts at 9 p.m. and goes until 2 a.m. We have a Facebook group for just New Orleans Poetry Brothel, and the event page is on there. They can look on the Always calendar. They can also email me at neworleanspoetrybrothel@gmail.com if they want more info or if they want to get involved for the next event. We're always looking for more poets, more performers.
And costumes, I believe, are encouraged?
Yes. If you come in costume, either Victorian, burlesque, or steampunk, you get a free poetry reading.
All right. I think steampunk is the way to go. Well, thank you so much for coming out, you can see the New Orleans Poetry Brothel in action in a performance called Rendezvous, November 29th at the Always Lounge from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. Poets have stamina, I think. So thank you so much, Jordan.
Thank you, Susan.
Larissa LeClaire is trained as an anthropologist and a photographer, and she's also a curator and writer. Today, we're talking with her in a very different role, that of librarian. And Larissa's is a very different kind of library. She's the founder of the Indie Photo Book Library, which began in 2010. The Indie Photo Book Library will be coming to town for an exhibit that's part of Photo NOLA, that annual celebration of New Orleans photography, and a curated show will be on view at the Contemporary Arts Center. Welcome to The Reading Life, Larissa.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So where did the idea for this unusual library come from?
I was talking with Blake Andrews, who's a photographer out in Oregon, and something just clicked, and I remember thinking back to my childhood and actually really loving my children's books that I had a collection of and playing library and loving being in that kind of space and environment. And so I did go to school for photography. I have a BFA in photography and a BA in anthropology. And when I went back for graduate school, I decided that I was less interested in being the photographer and more interested in talking about other people's work and historical photographs and things that were already out there and that had already been produced. You know, I also worked for a photography book publishing company. I've written a lot of photography book reviews, and so for the last 10 years or so, just been involved with the photo book industry and have been following sort of the developments of what's happening, particularly with self-publishing and independent and collaborative presses. You know, about 3 years ago, I was personally frustrated with not having a place to go to actually experience a lot of these self-published books in person. You know, I was looking at the winners of the Photography Book Now competition that was sponsored by Blurb and really wanting to see what the work was like rather than just online. And so I was at Yale University for a master class at the Beinecke Rare Book Library and was really, really inspired by one individual person, Peter Palmquist, who basically followed his own passion and started a collection of photography by women photographers throughout the history of photography. And it was sort of that last little bit of encouragement through his collection that I said, you know what, if I'm looking for this kind of space, I'm going to create it. And that's how the Indie Photo Book Library formed. It's an archive for self-published and independently published photography books. And right now I don't have a space, so over the last 2.5 years I've been traveling around the world, actually, China. There's an exhibition up in Guatemala City right now, and putting on pop-up exhibitions, pop-up library spaces, you know, month-long, almost traditional photography exhibitions, but with photography books, and lecturing at universities and photography festivals, and, you know, just sharing the amazing books that are being produced by photographers today who are doing it on their own.
Well, one of the things I love about your philosophy is that a book should be more than just a random collection of images.
Yeah, the most successful photography book for me are the ones where the photographer has really looked at how the work can be conveyed in book form, where it's not just a collection of photographs. It incorporates the photographer's artistic sensibility. It speaks to the photography work inside. It really brings to life the book as form, and it's all those components that are put together that really make sense. And when they do, what can be produced is extremely amazing.
So what's the joy for you in this work? It's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work, and actually it has completely grown to where I'm completely overwhelmed with the number of submissions that come in, and it has turned into a full-time job, even though it's a self-funded project. So it's definitely a labor of love. It's something I totally enjoy and believe in, and that's what keeps me going.
Well, we're very lucky that you're coming to New Orleans. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. There will be an Indie Photo Book Library pop-up exhibition during Photo NOLA. That's December 1st and 2nd at the Contemporary Arts Center. Larissa LeClaire presents a talk Friday, November 30th at 12:30 at the CAC. Thank you so much, Larissa.
Thank you very much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, continues all this week at the Hotel Monteleone and various locations throughout the French Quarter. Check out wordsandmusic.org for information and tickets. Donald Palmisano signs Little Red Book of Leadership Lessons Tuesday, November 27th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Jacob Tomsky discusses and signs Heads and Beds, a reckless memoir of hotels, hustles, and so-called hospitality. Wednesday, November 28th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Timothy J. Smith signs his novel Cooper's Promise, Wednesday, November 28th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Jonathan O'Dell, reads from and signs The Healing, Thursday, November 29th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Moira Crone, author of The Not Yet, and Michael Allen Zell, author of Errata, read from and sign their work Thursday, November 29th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Poets Carolyn Hembry and Christina Robinson are the featured readers in 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, Thursday, November 29th at 8 at the Goldmine Saloon. Today's guest, Jordan Soika, is the maitre d' of the Poetry Brothel, which takes place November 29th from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Always Lounge on St. Claude Avenue, by admission. Today's guest, Larissa LeClaire, presents a talk about the Indie Photo Book Library, Friday, November 30th at 12:30 at the Contemporary Arts Center. There will be an Indie Photo Book Library pop-up exhibition during Photo NOLA, and that's December 1st and 2nd at the Contemporary Arts Center. Ken Foster discusses and signs I'm a Good Dog, Saturday, December 1st at 1 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Mary Quattlebaum reads from and signs her children's books, Pirate vs. Pirate and The Hungry Ghost of Rue Orleans, Saturday, December 1st at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Dixon Hearn, author of When Christmas Was Real, and Valley Lynn Watson, author of A River So Long, read from and sign their work Saturday, December 1st from 1 to 3 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. The Melanated Writers Collective presents an afternoon of verse featuring the Whiting Award-winning writer Thomas Sayers Ellis, author of The Maverick Room and Skin, Ink, Identity Repair Poems, Sunday, December 2nd from 3 to 5 at Café Treme at 1501 St. Philip Street. Christopher Buhlman signs Between Two Fires, Monday, December 3rd at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The next reading at the 1718 Reading Series, sponsored by students at Tulane, Loyola, and the University of New Orleans, takes place Tuesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. at the Collins Hotel. And coming up, Natasha Trethewey, the United States Poet Laureate, presents a reading from her new book, Thrall, and Other Works, Thursday, December 6th at 7 p.m. at the New Orleans Public Library, Main Branch. Davey and Peter Rothbart are bringing the My Heart is an Idiot, Found Magazine's 10th Anniversary Tour, to New Orleans, Friday, December 7th at 8 p.m. at the Always Lounge. Expect to hear the latest Found messages and hear Davey Rothbart read from his bestseller, My Heart is an Idiot, by admission. And Heather Graham's Writers for New Orleans Conference takes place December 14th through 16th at the Hotel Monteleone. If you love genre fiction, come on out and meet Heather Graham, James Rollins, and David Morrell. For more information and ticket info, check out writersfornewOrleans.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.